Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Dr. Kiki's Science Hour with me, Dr. Kiki Sanford, episode 128, recorded January 12th, 2012, The Geology Ball. This episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All streamed directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. I'm Dr. Kiki Sanford. That was my cat snack. Just passing on through, as cats tend to do. Today is another episode full of science. You know you love it. We're going to be talking about geology with Jessica Ball. She is from the University of Buffalo, and I'm really looking forward to digging into the science of volcanoes with her. Volcanoes are very exciting, eruptive subjects to study, I guess you could say. But you know how this show goes. It's an hour of science so that you can dig into a subject, learn a lot about it. We got a single topic with a single expert for the remainder of the hour. But first, we have some science headlines. So let's get into those. Science headlines for this week. The Kepler mission found two more exoplanets. The excitement around the announcement at the American Astronomical Society meeting this week in Austin, Texas, revolves around the following piece of trivia. The planets called Kepler 34b and Kepler 35b both orbit around binary star systems, just like Tatooine makes these the second and third binary star planets that we have found. The finding implies that such systems might be rather common in the universe rather than the exception. Also at the AAS meeting in Austin, researchers presented an image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope of five bright young galaxies creating a galaxy cluster 13.1 billion years ago. The image supports the hierarchical hypothesis of galaxy assembly. And astronomers have discovered El Gordo, the big one, a massive galactic collision that took place 7 billion years ago. Observations of the collision will hopefully gain us information about the gravitational effects of dark matter. A statistical analysis of gravitational microlensing data was published in the journal Nature. Suggests that stars are orbited by planets in the Milky Way galaxy as a rule rather than the exception. The paper finds that two-thirds of stars in our galaxy should have an Earth-sized planet. So they're out there. The trick now is finding one in the habitable zone. So let's get looking. The Mars Images app allows you to download images from the Mars Rover Opportunity to your smartphone. Free iPhone and Android versions are available. The Earth has a new island. It was recently born from a volcanic eruption beneath the Red Sea. It's 2,000 feet across and has not yet been named. It snows in the ocean. Well, not really snow like you're used to, more like a rain of feces and decaying bodies. Sound appetizing? Well, it is to the organisms that live at the bottom of the sea. It's called marine snow, and it's extremely important to biodiversity on the ocean floor. Craig McLean of Deep Sea News published a study in the Proceedings of the Royal Society B on this topic. Where did oxygen come from on Earth? Scientists publishing in the journal Structure suggest that early organisms found a molecular solution to an abundance of hydrogen peroxide in their environment in the form of an enzyme called manganese catalase. The enzyme would degrade hydrogen peroxide to water and oxygen and appeared on the cellular scene about 2.9 billion years ago. The Ion Torrent division of Life Technologies announced this week that it will be releasing the Ion Proton Sequencer this year, a benchtop device that will sequence the entire human genome for around $1,000 in about one day. It's the holy grail of genome sequencing. If you are interested in one, start saving your pennies now, as the devices will cost approximately $150,000. Taiwanese and German researchers created a write-once, read-many-times optical data storage device using silver nanoparticles, some electrodes, and a layer of salmon DNA. Anyone trying for a bagel computer? I'd like mine on an everything. Oh, yeah. And there's a completely drug-resistant form of tuberculosis on the loose in India. Physicians are calling it totally drug-resistant TB, or TDR-TB for short. Like, totally. They sigh. That does it for the science headlines. Now for a word from our sponsor. This week's episode of Dr. Kiki Science Hour is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means that you save time, money, and hassle. There are several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac, your iPad, your iPhone, and even some Android devices. Additionally, if you have a gaming console like an Xbox 360 or a PS3 or a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. Or if you don't have one of those devices, you're not into gaming maybe, but you have a set-top box like Roku, or an Apple TV. You can use one of those inexpensive devices. They're also really easy to use and to access Netflix instantly. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV instantly using any of these devices. And the great thing about it is that it keeps track of where you stop watching a program. So if you're in the middle of some movie and you need to stop it and want to pick it up later, maybe get on the bus, you can pick up right where you left off, wherever you are. It's that easy with Netflix. Whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies and TV shows as you want, anytime you want, and you can cancel at any time. But you can try Netflix today for 30 days for free. All you have to do is go to netflix.com/twit. That's right. Use that URL, netflix.com/twit, when you sign up for your free trial. We thank Netflix for their support of Twit, and we hope that you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. Now on to the rest of our show. We have a great, great conversation. At least I hope it'll be fantastic, with our guest today, talking about the subject of geology and volcanoes. Jessica Ball is a graduate student in the Department of Geology at State University of New York at Buffalo. And according to her blog bio, she is learning there how to safely and productively play with very hot rocks. It sounds like a good skill. Might come in handy someday. End of the world, I don't know. It's 2012. Anything could happen. Her PhD research focuses on the interaction of water and lava domes and involves both field investigations and modeling applications. Her blogging covers a range of topics from life as a grad student to geoscience outreach to her field and lab work in volcanology. Without any further ado, Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks for inviting me on. I'm really happy to be here.
Yeah, it's great to get you on. I'm really interested in talking with you about what you do. I mean, volcanoes are, here comes the pun, ba-dum-bum, a hot topic.
Well, we do love geology puns, and you're definitely right. They are hot in terms of temperature and I think really interesting. So
tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into geology and specifically volcanoes? What's your science story?
So I guess for as long as I can remember, I've always been interested in geology. I grew up in the Washington, D.C. area, and we have the advantage of being very close to a lot of wonderful museums. And my parents took me there a lot, pretty much any time I asked to. And I was always really fascinated by the rocks and the dinosaurs and all sorts of things. And I just kept being interested in that for pretty much all through elementary and high school. And then when I finally got to college and got to take classes in geology, it was just the greatest thing. I was really excited about it. And that's pretty much been it. I guess most people don't go into college knowing exactly what they want to do. But for me, it was pretty obvious it was going to be geology.
I think that's really exciting. I myself did not know exactly what I was going to do. I was interested in saving the world, saving whales. I thought I'd end up working for Greenpeace or something. Instead, here I am talking to scientists about what they do and why they enjoy what they do. It's really rare, I think, that a do you think it's rare within the science community that when people get along the path that they, you know, did they start out knowing what they wanted to do? Or do you think it's, you know, there are a lot of people who fall into science?
Well, my experience is mainly with geologists, but I'd say it probably is pretty rare. I was just lucky enough to know that I wanted to do something and to enjoy doing it. But a lot of my friends and fellow grad students and professors didn't know that they wanted to be geologists. They started out somewhere else. Some of them were in majors that they decided were less interesting than the geology mm-hmm. classes they were taking for a requirement. But I think you're right. It is rare that people know what they want to do so early.
Yeah. We should figure out ways that we can get kids on a path, maybe when they're younger, to find out, you know, oh my gosh, I love geology. This is great. You know, get more kids exposed during their early education to scientific topics to maybe get more, so it doesn't become so rare.
Right. And that would be wonderful if we could do that.
Yeah. So volcanoes, not just geology, but volcanoes. Why do you like these big exploding things on the planet?
Well, any good geologist would tell you that the exploding is interesting enough. But I think it's just because you get so many processes going on in one place. They're changing the landscape continuously, some of them as you watch. And I just find that really fascinating. And I also really enjoy learning about the human aspect of how we respond to volcanic eruptions and, you know, how people deal with them when they're happening, what they do afterwards, and how volcanoes sort of shape human lives, even when they're not erupting.
Do you think volcanoes do have a huge impact on humanity, on society?
I think they do. I minored in anthropology and when I was in college, and a lot of the places that I studied for some archaeology classes that I took, a lot of them are in volcanic areas because the soil is rich, because it's a good place to grow crops, because there are minerals that they can mine. So I think that even in humanity's very earliest stages, volcanoes played a very major role. And they still do. I mean, you can even just look at the eruption in Iceland last year mm-hmm. and the impact that had just on, you know, travel. Nowadays, we don't really think of volcanoes as being big disruptions in world commerce, but that one certainly did a great deal to mess things up for people in a pretty short time.
Yeah, it's fascinating to me. I mean, so often we think we're above nature, you know, that we're outside of it somehow, that we can control it, that we have all this technology that we can get around. We fly through the air, you know, that's pretty amazing. We have instant communication through satellites and so many wonderful technologies. We fly through the air, yet, you know, the planet, you know, go back to the most primal forces of the planet and how do they work? How does the planet itself work? And then, you know, how does that interact with us on the surface? Tell me a little bit about the actual research that you do. Like what is you know, not just volcanoes and the fact that they erupt. We know they erupt. They cause great damage to environments when such eruptions do happen. But that's not the whole story about them, right?
Right, it's not. So the research that I do is about a pretty specific aspect of volcanoes. Lava domes are what you get when you get very sticky lava with a lot of silica in it, very glassy lava that piles up over a volcanic vent. And the thing about lava domes is that they're pretty unstable. They like to fall down. And so my work concentrates on why they fall down and how that's enhanced by the addition of water. So the field area that I work in is in Guatemala in Central America, and it's very wet down there. And the particular volcano that I study actually has four lava domes and not just one. And one of the most important parts of my research is to figure out what is happening within those lava domes with reference to water and why they're still standing, because in the past they've had some collapses, but not very major ones like we see it at other lava domes around the world.
What are the forces that actually lead to a lava dome forming? I mean, is it just pressure underneath the buildup? There's some kind of opening in the crust that allows lava to just start pushing upward?
So usually they form an event. So if you're familiar with Mount St. Helens erupting, this may be more familiar to an older audience, but I'm sure a lot of people have seen pictures of it. Mount St. Helens erupted really spectacularly. There was a big explosion. There was a landslide. But afterwards, what it started doing was squeezing out what was left over in the magma chamber. And what was left over wasn't as explosive as the first eruption because it had maybe less gas or the chemistry was different. So instead of exploding, it just sort of oozed, like if you had a tube of toothpaste and you were squeezing it up through a hole. Mm-hmm. That's basically what a lava dome is. It's a big old jumble pile of rock.
Okay. So instead of the explosion, you have gradual buildup.
Gradual. So a lot, yeah. And it's essentially a lava dome is a short lava flow, a very stubby lava flow. You could think of it that way.
And what other places could we think of those kinds of structures forming? Like a lot of people like to go to Hawaii. Do we see stuff like lava domes forming on the Hawaiian Islands?
I'm not familiar with any. I'm mostly familiar with the volcanoes and the big islands. So there might be domes on the other islands, but the places that I've seen them, in the Caribbean, there are volcanoes, particularly one that I visited is Soufriere Hills on the island of Montserrat. They have a lava dome there that has a habit of collapsing somewhat, not regularly, but more often than the one I look at. There are also lava domes on Indonesian volcanoes, Mount Merapi, which I believe was fairly active in the past year, has lava domes that grow and collapse. And then some of the Alaskan volcanoes in the Aleutian Islands form lava domes.
Has there ever been a problem with people not really realizing that there are these domes that collapse and trying to build on top of them or farm on top of them? Or is it pretty obvious that this is not a great place to put your society?
I think it's pretty obvious. Yeah, usually they're on the summit of a volcano or on the side of it, and they tend to be in craters. So you can see that something happened there at one point. But that doesn't necessarily stop people from trying to go see them really up close. On my volcano, there are several of the domes you can actually walk on. They're no longer erupting, and so they're reasonably safe if you take the right precautions. But there is one that is still erupting, and I've seen videos of people walking around on the summit while it's doing that, and those, frankly, just scare the pants off of me. Those people are lucky to be alive.
Yeah, there is a recent blog post of yours talking about actually being near a volcano when it was erupting. I mean, what's it like going out and doing your field work and, you know, being on a volcano? It's not like you can be miles and miles away from the volcano and really do accurate field work, right?
No, usually not. There's ways you can do remote sensing. So we use instruments like satellites or instruments that are left on the ground at a volcano mm-hmm. to do a lot of monitoring. But in some cases, yeah, you really do have to go up and get onto it. I think pretty much all volcanologists are very careful when they do that they don't make bad decisions about where they're going to go on the volcano and when they're going to be there, because they can kill you. You know, that's one really dangerous aspect of the job. The video that you're just talking about there was on the top of Stromboli, which is almost considered a tourist volcano in Italy. There are opportunities for people to go to the top of that and watch relatively small eruptions pretty up close at certain times. But then there are other times when the eruptions are more intense or more explosive and they don't let people up there.
What kind of signs does a volcano give off that it's going to be a more dramatic eruption? I mean, the Stromboli eruptions that are in the video that we were just looking at, I mean, obviously, tourists were there taking a look at it, and everyone was like, oh, maybe we shouldn't be so close anymore. But, you know, aside from getting there and going, maybe I shouldn't be here, what kind of signs do researchers use to actually say, okay, this is when I'm going to go do my research. This is, you know, this is when I'm going to stay away.
We use things like seismic activity, earthquakes within the volcano. So when you have magma moving around in there, it causes the rock to shift and to break inside a volcano. So you can pick that up on a seismograph. We also watch for things like a volcano changing shape. So we use instruments called tilt meters to see if the slopes of the volcano are getting steeper or shallower, which means that the volcanoes may be inflating or deflating, getting bigger or smaller. And that those react to magma moving around. And sometimes if you've been monitoring a volcano long enough, you can recognize patterns in how it erupts. So the domes that I study, I mentioned that one of them erupts fairly regularly. In fact, it erupts every couple of hours for the most part. But sometimes those eruptions are larger and make bigger plumes and get more violent and start creating these things called pyroclastic flows, which are big ash mm-hmm. and gas clouds that roll down the slopes of a volcano. And at my field area, when you start seeing those, that's when you stay out of the way.
Right. When you're looking at these lava domes and trying to figure out how water is involved in their collapse, their formation, their collapse. What kinds of samples are you going and collecting samples? Are you more interested in seismic activity? What kind of data are you actually going and collecting? And do you have to wear one of those heat reflective suits when you're on a volcano?
So the data that I collect, a lot of it is chemical data, geochemical data. So I look for things like, we call them alteration minerals, when volcanic gases have gotten into the rock in a lava dome and changed it often into things like clays, which are much weaker than lava, than the dome rocks, and can help it collapse. Some of the work I've been doing has been with information that people have collected about hot springs. So the chemistry of the hot springs can near a volcano can sometimes tell you about what's going on inside it. If I had a lot of money and more funding and a lot of maybe a helicopter or two, I could do something like a geophysical survey where you use electricity, sort of like a CAT scan or magnetic sensors to try and image the inside of a dome. But that's one thing that I haven't done because that's a little bit outside the scope of my work.
Right. And being able to get the funding to get that equipment or get access right. to it is probably difficult.
It is, yeah. The nice thing about my field area is that the domes that I'm working on are not active anymore, so they're actually not very hot. There are little gas vents called fumaroles that, the area that I worked in, mostly release steam, water vapor. A lot of the gas that comes out is just plain old water. And in this case, they actually weren't very hot, so it was fairly easy to collect the samples that I needed from that part of the domes.
Nice. How did you choose the volcanoes or the system of lava domes that you're studying?
So this actually came up when I was interviewing at graduate schools, going to talk to different advisors about the projects they had in mind. And my advisor, who mostly works in Montserrat on the dome at Soufriere Hills, had been discussing my volcano, Santiago, with another volcano researcher who's been down there, working down there for decades now. And he suggested some aspects of research that hadn't really been looked at yet. And in our case, what interested us was why the domes haven't really collapsed very often.
Right. Yeah. What holds them up?
What holds them up?
Yeah.
I think, and this is the result of my research so far, I think what's happened to these domes is that because of the way they're built, they're basically these big rubble piles that have lava flows on top of them. And I think what may be happening is that those lava flows are actually sort of armoring the outside of the domes and keeping what's underneath them from falling over, falling down, or collapsing.
So kind of like when you put plaster over a balloon and then pop the balloon inside.
Something
after,
like that, yeah.
After it's a lot dried.
Right. Yeah. There's sort of a shell on the outside of the domes, you might say. And we think that may be one major reason why they haven't collapsed. But, you know, we're still looking at different things, and we're not sure that's the only reason, but it's certainly a big one.
Yeah. How does this apply at all, the understanding how these lava domes form, how they stay stable and don't collapse? How does this apply more broadly, or does it have any other, I guess, implications for geosciences?
Right. So the broader applications are really in what we call hazard assessment, what we do to try and determine what kinds of volcanic hazards people might face when they're living in an area that maybe has a lava dome or a volcano that erupts in it. And in the case of Santiago, there are actually a lot of coffee plantations built around the volcano and directly south below the domes, downslope of the domes. And so what I would love to be able to do with this research is use it to help the people in Guatemala, especially the scientists who work there, improve what they know about the hazards at the domes and then pass that on to the people who live near them.
Have you, by doing your field work there, have you gotten to know people in the community? Is it something that people in the community think about, or is it just like, oh yeah, those lava domes over there?
Well, I've only actually been able to go down there for a few weeks at a time in the past couple of field seasons. But the impression that I get is that they're aware that the domes are there and that eruptions happen because it disrupts their lives sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, every few months or so, something happens that they have to take notice of. But they maybe don't know a whole lot about what could happen on a larger scale than just the eruptions. The last big, really big collapse at the domes was in 1929, and that's pretty much out of living memory by now. Yeah. You know, that in the middle of the century, there might have still been people who remembered that from seeing it firsthand, but now they've only got accounts of what happened. And people, the last time I was there, we were told that people had actually started farming on old collapse deposits from that that 1929 collapse. So they're going back to places that, only a few decades ago were devastated.
Yeah. As far as the 1929 collapse, what specifically, what kind of severity, like how big was the collapse that, and how did it affect them? Were people just encroaching too closely?
So what had happened was that there were, as there are now, there were coffee plantations and farms of various sorts underneath, below the domes. I keep saying it's downslope from the domes, really.
Yeah.
And the people there were unlucky enough to have gathered in a few of these towns for, I believe it was the Day of the Dead celebration, because this happened at the end of October. And there were probably thousands of them in just a few towns for the night, because they were all staying with friends. And when the collapse happened, it killed, we think, thousands of people. The official numbers that were reported right afterwards were hundreds, but probably they were much more than that.
Right, because there were more than just the people who lived in the towns there for the celebration.
Exactly. Yeah. And they knew that the volcano was there because it had been erupting for, I think, 7 or 8 years by then, but they didn't really know what it could do. And they really had no warning. So the collapse that happened was, the effects of it were something sort of similar to what we saw at Mount St. Helens, but on a much smaller scale. So you have something called a pyroclastic surge, which is very hot gases and some ash, and basically the people were suffocated. Some of them were burned pretty badly, but they would have had to have known something was going on long before it happened in order to get out of there. And at that time, they really had no warning.
Is there better warning now?
There is. They have an observatory there with people monitoring the volcano full time now, and they're able to issue warnings about when the activity is ramping up and getting worse. And people, I think, are more informed about what the volcano could do. They do a lot of work to go out in the community and talk to people about it. But one of the main problems, because this is Guatemala and people there live on much less income than we do, they don't have access to the transportation they would need to get out quickly. Most of them walk to work. Sometimes they walk miles a day just to get to their jobs. And so they would be able to get warnings, but whether they would be able to efficiently get people out of the way is questionable.
It sounds like when you start thinking about hazard warning systems and hazard assessment, we've got volcanoes in areas like this in Guatemala. We have tsunamis at coastal regions. We have a lot of systems in areas of the world that have, I guess, economic troubles that affect how easily the solutions can be implemented.
Right. And that's one thing that the volcanologists sort of wrestle with is, if you've got an active volcano and you think you need to issue a warning, how much of a warning? Do you want people to leave immediately? Do you want to tell them, well, we think something might be happening, so you should be ready? And then you have to do that in a way that makes them think that you are taking into account the possibility of them maybe losing money from a business that they couldn't run in that time. Or you have to help, not necessarily the scientist side of it, but the scientists working with the civil authorities need to find ways to reassure them that maybe their property is going to be protected if they have to leave. And this is something that comes up in a lot of places. It's been an issue in the Caribbean in the past. It's been, actually, it's an issue almost all the time in Colombia, near Galera's volcano, which is pretty active.
In terms of volcanoes and the danger that communities are in as a result of the amount of activity that a volcano has, do you think? I mean, we've got here on the west coast of the United States, up north, we've got Seattle and a pretty vibrant well-populated area, very close to some active volcanoes. Is there a lot of danger to people? Do people regularly just say, oh, I'm just going to build, forget about what we saw with Pompeii, I'm just going to build right near a volcano?
I think that we know a lot about those volcanoes. I mean, there have been people working to map older deposits and say what's happened there in the past. And in a lot of cases, they're national parks to begin with, so they're not going to let people build their house right in the middle of it. But that is definitely an issue. It's near Mount Rainier. There's mud flows from times that the volcano has erupted and melted ice caps and sent mud down the sides. And communities are actually built on those mud flows now. But on the flip side, they know that. People in those communities know that, and they have systems in place to practice evacuations in case something that happens. And the volcanoes on the West Coast are pretty well monitored. You know, there's somebody watching them all the time, and they know whenever even the smallest amount of seismic activity is starting up. So I think they've got a pretty good handle on what's going on and when they need to start thinking about emergency situations. And hopefully the people who live there pay attention to their scientists and have educated themselves a little bit about what might happen to them.
Absolutely. On the flip side of, you know, volcanoes danger and the kind of sensationalist message of, you know, volcanoes could erupt at any minute, these active volcanoes are dangerous, there's a lot of just, I guess we were talking earlier, the more mundane side of volcanology, of studying the volcanoes, of actually learning about the geological processes that are going on. Can you talk a little bit about the other side of the work that you do?
Right. Yeah. So it sounds pretty, you know, exotic and exciting going off to visit volcanoes in Guatemala and Italy. But actually, on the whole, volcanologists spend a lot more of their time in the lab, either working with samples or in front of a computer, working with data they've collected in the field. You know, maybe we get to spend a couple of weeks a year in the field grabbing what we can, and then we take it back. And the rest of the year, we're crunching numbers, we're looking at chemical analyses, or we're looking at satellite images and trying to figure out whatever we can from that. But very few volcanologists are lucky enough to get to spend their time in the field the whole time all year. So a lot of my work recently has been looking at satellite images to try and figure out where bedrock on my volcano has been altered by gases. And that's actually been really useful because volcanoes in general are hard to get to and they're hard to navigate even when you get out there. So using these methods and information from far away can be just as useful as working in the field.
How much data do you have to work with? Are you grappling with giant data sets, or are they fairly limited in scope?
Because of the particular field area I work in, because it's hard to get to it, it's hard to get out onto the domes, and even when you're there, you have to bring everything with you and support yourself. I actually don't have a lot of data. And the field work and the data that I've got from there are actually only about half of my thesis. So, you know, for me, it's not a ridiculous amount. For other people, you know, they're out there monitoring things with seismometers, or they've got other fun instruments out there, and they have enormous data sets to deal with. So I'd say it varies.
In terms of the data that you're working with, coming from the biology side of things, people are talking about open science all the time, open data. And there are government initiatives to open up NASA data sets and make data available. Is this happening in geology, in volcanology? It really seems like this would be an area that would benefit from it.
Right. And I think it is happening. Generally, you know, when we're doing the work and we're getting ready to write papers or a thesis about it, we're not going to put all of our data out on the internet somewhere. But What we are starting to do, and this is actually something that Buffalo, University of Buffalo has started up, is create clearinghouses for data online. So in Buffalo's case, this is a website called vhub.org, and it's supposed to be a place where volcano researchers can share things like data sets that they've worked with or presentations that they've created about particular topics they're familiar with, or even modeling tools that they've created. And we're hoping that this becomes a really useful thing for people, because it's great to do research, but if other people don't know about it, then it's not very useful to them.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think scientists are really moving towards being more collaborative and sharing information like this.
Yeah. And historically, the sharing of information has been through publications or through scientific meetings. So it's neat to see that there's, you know, that's this extra step of starting to share the information. Speaking of scientific meetings, you were one of the bloggers for the American Geophysical Union meeting, which, annually meets in San Francisco. And I keep missing it. I live here in San Francisco and I keep missing the meeting. It's like every year I'm like, oh, that's already? Oh my gosh. I hope to get to it this next year. I'm going to put it on my calendar and be ready for it. What was happening this year at AGU? What kind of it seems like that in terms of sharing science and sharing news, is there a lot of stuff that comes out at the meeting that is really applicable to, you know, a number of fields that's very just broadly applicable to the geosciences in general?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, it's AGU is a massive meeting. There's more than 20,000 people that participate in it every year. So, you know, even a very small percentage of that is applicable to a broad range of topics. You're still getting quite a bit of research that you can use sort of across the spectrum in the geosciences. And recently, AGU has started putting more talks and more posters even online for people to look at. And you don't have to be a member of AGU to do that. You can just call up their website and watch whatever you feel like. And I think, you know, with web streaming and with just even putting a PDF online is a great way to share the current research. And as a blogger, I kind of had a unique perspective because they gave us press passes. So we got to not only hang out with all the scientists, but we got to spend time with the press, people from newspapers and magazines and online sources, and see things from their perspective. And sometimes they get a lot of their science from press releases. But those tend to be condensed and they don't necessarily offer a whole lot of time for discussion. So this move towards putting more of the raw science, you could say, online for people to look at is, I think, a really good one because you're not just getting things filtered through a newspaper. You're getting it right from the source and hearing what the scientists want you to know about it.
I think that's great. Yeah, opening it up. And then additionally, it makes those resources available to the journalists. So the journalists maybe have a little bit extra information before they go about writing their stories.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. For the meeting in San Francisco, there was some interesting results that you wrote about on your blog, some interesting presentations that were there. Can you tell me a little bit about which ones you thought were really insightful, that had maybe were big science, things that you were really excited about?
Well, oh gosh, it's hard to sort of sift through everything that you see at those meetings and think about it. Actually, a lot of the big science does get out in the press conferences. One in particular that I thought was really interesting was how things like volcanic activity and seismic activity and earthquakes can be affected by climate. And this was actually a trio of researchers, one who was working in Iceland on the volcanoes there, one who was working in Haiti with some of the faults there. And then another was working in on the Tibetan Plateau. And what they've been finding in this research is that things like a stronger monsoon season or water getting into faults and lubricating them and making them slip more easily, or ice caps melting more often, can actually have an effect on geological activity, things like earthquakes and volcanic eruptions. And so that brings into view the whole question of, you know, what are we doing to climate, and how could this actually be affecting what the Earth is doing in response?
Yeah, I've been over the last few years, the idea that ice cap melt could add more water to the oceans, and hence you could have a greater mass of water pushing down onto the crust, that could affect earthquakes, cause more earthquakes to take place. And it just seems like one of those just kind of out there ideas. It's like, really, more water can cause earthquakes to take place? It's hard to think of the crust of the earth, this solid thing that we stand on, as more of a fluid entity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one thing that you sort of appreciate more as a geologist, is that what most people regard is something really static, and it's always been that way, and it's always just going to be there, can actually change really dramatically, and it can sometimes change because of things we do.
Do you know much? I mean, this is off topic, but there's a similar topic with fracking recently, where it's not water on the planet's surface or increased monsoon activity, but we're forcing water and gases mm-hmm. down under the earth and affecting earthquakes. Do you know much
right.
about that?
So I know a little bit, because this is something that gets discussed in New York a lot, since we have a lot of the Marcellus Shale, which is supposed mm-hmm. to be a big natural gas producer. And I think what they've been starting to find, or have been finding for a little while, is that introducing water into sort of unstable subsurface areas can cause small earthquakes. I think they've been finding that in Arkansas and Ohio recently. And so that's starting to call into question, you know, how safe the whole fracking process is, not just, you know, what that water is bringing up out of the ground, but what it's doing to geologic structures as well.
Yeah, what actually happens beneath the surface when you pump that water down there, water that right. wasn't there to begin with.
Right, and pumping the water in is the whole point. You know, you're trying to break something, and mm-hmm. Sometimes you don't just break what you want to break, I think, is what's happening there.
It's just kind of a brute force method that maybe, mm-hmm. yeah. Instead of having a nice fine pair of fine tip forceps, it's like using a shovel to get a splinter out of your finger.
Yeah, something like that, maybe.
Maybe. With the thinking about climate, weather, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions, is there evidence that somebody in the chat room is like, weather doesn't affect earthquakes? I mean, people talk about, you know, there's, you know, maybe the guy on the front porch in the rocking chair is like, oh, it's earthquake weather. You know, are these places where these two worlds might be colliding a little bit?
Yeah, I think it is important to sort of consider that. I mean, the one really important thing to remember is the difference between weather and climate. You know, weather is the sort of local short-term thing, but climate is looking at weather patterns over large areas and long-term. And, you know, climate is changing. We know it's changing. And many things that geologists are doing nowadays involve looking at how natural systems are responding to those changes.
Yeah. There's a lot left to learn, I think.
There definitely is, yeah.
For your blogging and what you try and do with blogging, we're coming to the end of the hour here. I'd like to touch a bit on how you got into blogging and moved, I guess, from being just a strict scientist into writing about science and trying to communicate it.
Right. So I actually started blogging during a year I took off from school. So when I graduated from college, I took a year to work at the American Geosciences Institute, which is a nonprofit organization. And totally separate from anything I was doing for work, I was looking at graduate schools and saying, you know, where do I want to go? And one thing that I was really interested in was finding out about what people's experiences were as students in graduate school. And I found out that a lot of people in biological science and medical science blog about what's going on. But at that time, which was in 2008, there weren't a lot of geology students talking about their experience. In fact, if I'm remembering right, there weren't any. And so I sort of thought to myself, well, why don't I write about this? You know, it'll be useful for someone else later, and maybe they'll pull it up and say, oh, you know, somebody's had the same problems or the same concerns or the same triumphs as I have. And it's great to, to see someone else doing that. So I started writing the blog on my own, just on an independent website, and writing about little things, you know, the application process of trying to get into grad school and how to choose the one you want to go to. And then I started writing about volcano topics because I like volcanoes, and I thought it was cool to sort of start covering current events a little bit. And then I started meeting up with other bloggers, in some cases, mostly online, and seeing what they were talking about. And that got me interested in things like how science is communicated nowadays with new social media networks and things like that. And being in graduate school has also made me really interested in how science is taught and what are effective ways to do it and what are good ways to get lay people interested in it. And so the blogging just went on with that. And then a year ago, I was approached by AGU and asked if I wanted to join their blogging network with some other people that I knew. And at the moment, initially I was thinking, oh, wow, somebody will take care of all the technical stuff for me. That'll be great. Right. I don't have to do that anymore. Right. And then the second thought was, wow, you know, a lot of people are going to read this. Maybe I have a chance to say something that really makes an impact.
And? Do you think you've made an impact? Are a lot of people reading it?
I hope I have. I've had people come up to me at the meetings and say, you know, I really enjoy your blog. I thought this post was good, or, you know, why didn't you do this in this post? And so the feedback is definitely useful. It's been really rewarding for me, I think, because as a scientist, one of the most important things is to know how to communicate what you're doing to people and why it's important and why they should be interested in it. And with blogging, you have to do that a lot. You have to do that in a way that people outside your area of expertise understand, and you have to find a way to keep their interest in it. And I think blogging is a great way to do that.
Have you had any scientific benefits from blogging, where people have come up with ideas to help you with your research or potential collaborations?
I would say not yet, but there's always the possibility. I've made a lot of connections on the blog that I would never have done, you know, people totally outside my area of research. And there's always the chance that we could come up with some ideas that would turn into papers or research projects in the future. So it certainly wouldn't rule it out.
I hope you put yourself out there. You never know what will come back, and you know,
that's right.
maybe there will be some wonderful collaborations for you in the future from your scientific audience. We are at the end of the hour. Unfortunately, this has been really interesting. Going back, I have one final question. Going back to the idea of volcanoes and extinctions, you kind of brought up that idea at the beginning of the hour. There's a book that I read by Amos Noor on the idea of earthquakes and the wrath of God. Volcanoes, earthquakes, the wrath of God. And it's this idea that, you know, volcanoes, volcanic eruptions, these cataclysmic events in human lives actually have massive cultural implications. Do you hope that that your work has some kind of culture, that it goes on beyond just the scientific aspects to have those cultural benefits?
Mm-hmm. It's a little hard to think in that long term of a way, but I hope that at least the work that I'm doing now will be useful for people who are trying to find ways to live with volcanoes, and not just in the area that I do the research in Guatemala, but, you know, maybe in other places around the world. And I think the more that people know about eruptions and how volcanoes behave, not the more comfortable they'll be with them, but the more prepared they'll be when something like a cataclysmic eruption occurs. And I hope that'll, you know, help them in some way, I think is the goal of a lot of research, is that we want to help people.
Great. Well, I hope that your research is fruitful, that you are able to get all the data you need to finish your graduate thesis.
I hope that too.
I'm sure lots more fun field work, hard work, and you're going to have some great publications and a completed thesis, and eventually that feeling of satisfaction.
Yeah, well, that's the goal.
Yeah, good luck with all of your work and completing your PhD work. It's definitely worth it in the end. I hope that you go on to some really good work, and that I can have you back on the show in the future to talk more about it. I think it would be great.
I think that would be great too.
Excellent. Everyone, thank you very much for watching. Jessica Ball, thank you very much for joining us here on Dr. Kiki Science Hour, and for all the information about volcanoes, geology, culture, the things that come out of looking at the Earth. There's a lot to be discussed. Be sure to visit her blog, blogs.agu.org/magmacumlaude, or follow at Tough Cookie, Tough T-U-F-F underscore cookie, for more information about geology and volcanoes and being a graduate student in the geosciences. I am Dr. Kiki, and this has been Dr. Kiki's Science Hour. We are at the end of the hour once again, and next week we're talking about going to space, launching ourselves off of this rock. Until then, you can follow my sciencey pursuits on Twitter, on Facebook. I am Dr. Kiki. Google+, I am Kiki Sanford. And you can subscribe to the show in iTunes, or you can go to twit.tv/Kiki for more episodes. There are lots of past episodes out there. As you can see, we are on episode 128 this week. There's a lot of stuff out there. Lots of stuff, I know, but I will see you next week. I do hope that you'll be back. Thanks for tuning into the show. And remember, all I ask for is 1 hour a week, just 1 hour. And I do hope that 1 hour a week makes your world a whole lot more interesting. Now for your science meditation of the week.
About 4 months ago, we introduced the iPads to the gorillas. About a month after that, we allowed the orangutans to have their exposure to it through the public glass windows. The orangutans were allowed to watch different videos of other animals in the park, of themselves. They could also interact with it as if it was a mirror. We could record their reactions and then turn the iPad around and show them their previous reactions to it. Right away from the orangutans, we had immediate positive response. It was really exciting to watch their amazement, an instant interest in what was taking place on the iPad. And as they started to realize that they could interact with it, it became even more positive. About a month after we gave them their first opportunity to view the iPad through the public screen, then I started working with the orangutans through the mesh barrier, where I would hold up the iPad. I wouldn't give it to them. We still haven't progressed to any point like that, because they're very powerful animals and they would probably destroy it in an instant. But I push it up to the mesh, and then they can react. They like many of the free apps that I think children would like. They like the free apps where you can finger paint They like the apps where you can use the drums, you know, and you pound on the drums or the strum the guitar, the music apps. Mahal, our four-year-old male orangutan, is very interested in himself, like all four-year-olds are. He loves to watch video of himself. He loves to watch anything that it can interact. He also likes to watch other orangutans his age. MJ, our adult female, she's 31 years old. She is very interested in watching male orangutans, which is probably no big surprise. She likes to watch our male Tom, video of him. She also likes to watch herself. She also really enjoys some of the interactive books. We provide enrichment for all of our primates, the great apes and all of our monkey species, on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day. We try to keep them engaged. We try to stimulate them mentally and physically. We use a variety of means to do that, and the iPads are just one tool that we use.